From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. But You'll Never Follow Me by Carl Edward Wagner. It wasn't the smell of death that he hated so much. He'd grown used to that numb. It was the smell of dying that tore at him, slow dying. He remembered his best buddy stuck to the paddy mud, legless and eviscerated, too deep in shock to cry out, just gulping air like a beach fish, eyes round with wonder and staring into his. Marsden had closed those eyes with his right hand, and with his left he put a 45 slug through his friend's skull. After that, he'd made a promise to himself never to kill again. But that was as true a promise as he'd ever made to anyone, and he never intended lies rotted together with the never-realized truths of his best intentions. Marsden found a moment's solitude in the slow-moving elevator as it slid upward to the fourth floor. He cracked a zippered gash into his bulky canvas flight bag, large enough to reach the pint bottle of vodka on top. He gulped down a mouthful, replaced the stopper, and then replaced the flask, tugged down the zipper, all in the space of four floors. Speed was only a matter of practice. He exhaled a breath of vodka as the elevator door opened. Perhaps the middle-aged couple who waited there noticed his breath as he shouldered past them with his bag, but Marsden doubted it. The air of Brookcrest Healthcare Center was already choked with a stench of bath salts and old ladies' perfume, with antiseptics and detergents and bouquets of dying flowers, and underlying it all was the veiled sweetness of urine, feces, and vomit, physically retained in bedpans and diapers. Marsden belched. A nurse in the fourth floor lounge scowled at him, but a blue-haired lady in a jerry cart smiled and waved and called after him. "Billy boy! Billy, Billy boy!" Michael Marsden shut his eyes and turned into the hallway that led to his parents' rooms. Somewhere along the hall, a woman's voice begged in feeble monotone, "O Lord, help me. O Lord, help me. O Lord, help me." Marsden walked on down the hall. He was a middle-aged man with a heavy-set frame that carried, well, a spreading beer gut. He had mild brown eyes, a lined and long-jawed face, and there were streaks of gray in his short beard and his limp brown hair, which straggled from beneath the giant's baseball cap. His denim jacket and jeans were about as worn as his scuffed cowboy boots. "You'd look a lot nicer if you'd shave that beard and get a haircut," Mama liked to nag him. "And you ought to dress more neatly. You're a good-looking boy, Michael." She still kept a photo of him in his uniform, smiling bravely, fresh out of boot camp, on her shelf at the nursing home. Marsden guessed that was the way Mama preferred to hold him in memory, such of her memory as Alzheimer's disease had left her. Not that there was much worth remembering him for since then. Certainly the rest of his family wouldn't quarrel with that judgment. "You should have gone back to grad school once you got back," his sister in Columbus had advised him with 20/20 and 20-year hindsight. "What have you done with your life instead? When was the last time you held on to a job for more than a year?" At least she hadn't added, "or held on to a wife." Marsden had sipped his Coke and vodka and meekly accepted the scolding. They were seated in the kitchen of their parents' too big house in Cincinnati, trying not to disturb Papa as he dozed in his wheelchair in the family room. "It's bad enough that Brett and I having to keep driving down here every weekend to try to straighten things out here," Nancy had reminded him, "and then Jax had to come down from Detroit several times since Mama went to Brookcrest, and Jonathan flew here from Los Angeles and stayed 2 whole weeks after Papa's first stroke. And all of us have jobs and families to keep up with. Where were you during all this time?" "Trying to hold a job in Jersey," Marsden explained, thinking of the last Christmas he'd come home. He'd been nursing a six-pack in a late-night movie, when Mama drifted into the family room and angrily ordered him to get back to mowing the lawn. It was the first time he'd seen Mama naked in life, and the image of that shrunken, sagging body would not leave him. "I'm just saying that you should be doing more, Michael," Nancy continued. "I was here when you needed me," Marston protested. "I was here to take Mama to the nursing home." "Yes, but that was after the rest of us did all the work. Finding a good home, signing all the papers, convincing Papa that this was the best thing to do, making all the other arrangements. Still, I was here at the end. I did what I had to do," Marston said, thinking that this had been the story of his life ever since the draft notice had come. Never a choice. They hadn't wanted to upset Mama, so no one had told her about the nursing home. Secretly, they'd packed her things and loaded them into the trunk of Papa's Cadillac the night before. "Just tell Mama that she's going for another checkup at the hospital," they told them to say, and then they had to get home to their jobs and families. But despite her advanced Alzheimer's, Mama's memory was clear when it came to remembering doctor's appointments, and she protested suspiciously the next morning when he and Papa bundled her into the car. Mama had looked back over her shoulder at him as they wheeled her down the hall, and her eyes were shadowed with the hurt of betrayal. "You're going to leave me here, aren't you?" she said dully. The memory of that look crowded memories of Nam from his nightmares. After that, Marston had avoided going home. He did visit Mama briefly when Papa had his first stroke, but she hadn't recognized him. Papa had survived his first stroke, and several months later had surprised them all again and survived his second stroke. But that had been almost a year ago, from the night Marston and his sister had sat talking in the kitchen while Papa dozed in his wheelchair. That first stroke had left him weak on one side. The second had taken away part of his mind. The family had tried to maintain him at home with live-in nursing care, but Papa's health slowly deteriorated physically and mentally. It was time to call for Michael, and Michael came. "Besides," Nancy reassured him, "Papa only wants to be near Mama. He still insists on trying to get over to visit her every day. You can imagine what a strain that's been on everyone here." "I can guess," said Michael, pouring more vodka into his glass. "Where are we going, son?" Papa had asked the next morning, as Marston lifted him into the Cadillac. Papa's vision was almost gone now, and his voice was hard to understand. "I'm taking you to be with Mama for a while," Marston told him. "You want that, don't you?" Papa's dim eyes stared widely at the house as they backed down the driveway. He turned to face Michael. "But when are you bringing Mama and me back home again, son?" "Never," as it turned out. Marsden's paused outside his mother's room, wincing at the memory. Over the past year, the various health problems had continued their slow and inexorable progress towards oblivion. Meanwhile, health care bills had mushroomed, eroding insurance coverage, the last of their pensions, and a lifetime's careful savings. It was time to put the old family home on the market, to make some disposal of a lifetime's possessions. It had to be done. Papa called for Michael. "Don't let them do this to us, son." The family held power of attorney now. "Mama and I want to go home." So Michael came home. The white-haired lady bent double over a walker as she inched along the hallway, wasn't watching him. Marston took a long swig of vodka and replaced the pint bottle. Mama didn't like to see him drink. She was sitting up in her cherry cart, staring at the television, when Marston stepped inside a room and closed the door. They'd removed her dinner tray, but hadn't cleaned up, and bits of food littered the front of her dressing gown. She looked up, and her sunken eyes showed recognition. "Why, it's Michael," she held out her food-smeared arms him. "My baby." Marsden accepted her slobbery hug. "I've come for you, Mama," he whispered, as Mama began to cry. She covered her face with her hands and continued weeping as Marsden stepped behind her and opened the flight bag. The silencer was already fitted to the high standard 22, and Marsden quickly pumped three hollow points through the back of his mother's head. It was over in seconds, little noise, and surely no pain. No more pain. Marsden left his mother slumped over in her jerry cart, picked up his canvas bag, and closed the door. Then he walked on down the hall to his father's room. He went inside. Papa must have been getting up and falling again because he was tied to his wheelchair by a bath towel about his waist. "Who's that?" he mumbled, turning his eyes towards Marston.
"It's Michael, Papa. I'm here to take you home."
Papa lost sphincter control as Marston untied the knotted towel. He was trying to say something. It sounded like, "Bless you, son." Then Marston lovingly shot him 3 times through the back of his skull. Papa would have fallen out of the wheelchair, but Marston caught him. He left him sitting upright with the Monday night football game just getting underway on the tube. Marston finished the vodka, then removed the silencer from the pistol and replaced the clip. Shoving the high standard into his belt, he checked over the flight bag and left it with Papa. He heard the first screams as the elevator door slowly closed. Someone must have finally gone to clean Mama's dinner off her. A uniformed security guard, Marston hadn't known that Brookcrest employed such, was trying to lock the lobby doors. A staff member was shouting into the reception desk phone. "Hold it, please. Nobody's to leave." The guard actually had a revolver. Marston shot him through the left eye and stepped over him and through the glass doors. Marston regretted this because he hated to kill needlessly. Unfortunately, the first police car was slithering into the parking lot as Marston left the nursing home. Marston continued to walk away, even the car spotlight pinned him against the blacktop. "You there, freeze!" They must have already been called to the home. Marston thought time was short. Without breaking stride, he drew his .22 and shot out the spotlight. There were still the parking lot lights. Gunfire flashed from behind both front doors of the car, and Marston sensed the impact of buckshot and 9mm slugs. He was leaping for the cover of a parked car, and 2 more police cars were hurtling into the parking lot when the 20 pounds of C4 he'd left with Papa went off. The blast lifted Marston off his feet and fragged him with shards of glass and shattered brick. Brookcrest Healthcare Center burst open like the birth of a volcano. 2 police cars were overturned, the other on fire. The nursing home was collapsing into flaming rubble. No human screams could be heard through the thunder disintegrating brick and steel. Marston rolled to his feet, brushing away fragments of debris. He retrieved his pistol, but there was no need for it just now. His clothes were in a bad state, but they could be changed. There was no blood. Just he had known there would not be. They couldn't kill him in Nam, that day in the paddy when he learned what he was and why he was. They couldn't kill him now. Was it any easier when they were your own loved ones? Yes, perhaps it was. Michael Marston melted away into the darkness that had long ago claimed him. The Tunnel of Love by Robert Bloch. The entrance to the tunnel had been painted to resemble a woman's mouth, with cupid bow lips bordering it in vivid red. Marco stared into the yawning darkness beyond. A woman's mouth. How often had he dreamed of it, this past winter? Now he stood before the entrance, stood before the mouth, waiting to be engulfed. Marco was all alone in the amusement park. None of the other concessionaires had come to inspect their property and put it in working order for the new season. He was all alone, standing before the mouth, the scarlet mouth that beckoned him to come, be swallowed, be devoured. It would be so easy to run away, to clear out, and never come back. Maybe when the summer season opened, he could sell the concession. He'd tried all winter long, but there'd been no takers, even at a ridiculously low price. Yes, he could sell out and go away, far away, away from the tunnel. Away from the red mouth with its black throat, gaping for some human morsels. But that was nonsense, dream stuff, nightmare. The Tunnel of Love was a good stand, a moneymaker. A 4 month take was enough to support him for an entire year. And he'd needed the money, needed it more than ever since he'd married Dolores. Perhaps he shouldn't have married her in view of his troubles, but in a way that's just why he had to marry her. He wanted something to cling to. Something to shout out the fears that came to him at night. She loved him, and she would never suspect. There was no need for her to suspect, if he kept his own head. Everything was going to be all right once the season started. Now all he needed to do was check up on his equipment. The ticket booth was in good shape. He opened it and found no damage through leaking or frost. A good coat of paint would help, and he'd put a new stool inside for Dolores. She'd sell the tickets next season and cut down on his overhead.
All he need bother about would be running the boats through, showing them off and docking them for the benefit of the giggling couples who eagerly tasted the delights of the tunnel of love. Marco had checked the 6 gondolas stored in the shed behind the boards fronting his concession. All were sound. The treadmill motor was oiled and ready. The water intake and outlet were unrusted. He had dragged one of the flat-bottomed gondolas out, and it lay ready for launching once he flooded the channel and started the treadmill operation. Now he hesitated before the tunnel entrance. This was it. He had to make up his mind once and for all. Would he? Turning his back deliberately on the jaws of the monster, he had to stop thinking like that. He had to. Marco stepped over and opened the water. It ran down into the channel, a thin brown trickle, a muddy jet, a gushing frothy stream. The tunnel swallowed it. Now the treadmill was obscured, the water rushed into the tunnel full force. It rose as it flowed until the normal depth of 3 feet was attained. Marco watched it pour into the mouth. The mouth was thirsty, thirsty for water, thirsty for... Marco closed his eyes. If only he could get rid of that crazy notion about mouths. Funny thing, the exit of the tunnel didn't bother him at all. The exit was just as big, just as black. The water would rush through the entrance, complete the circuit of the tunnel, and emerge on the other side from the exit. It would sweep over the dry treadmill, clean out the dirt and the debris, the accumulation of past months. It would sweep it out clean, bring everything from the tunnel. It was coming now, yes. He could hear it now. He wanted to run. He couldn't look. But Marco had to look. He had to know. He had to find out what floated on that bubbling, gurgling stream. Had to see what bobbed and twisted in the torrent that emerged from the tunnel exit. The water trickled that he'd churned, swept out in a raging and majestic tide. Marco knelt in the gutter and stared down at the flow. It would be a hemorrhage. It would be blood. He knew that. But how could it be? Marco stared and saw that it wasn't blood. Nothing emerged from the tunnel but dirty water. Dirty water carrying caravels of leaves, a fleet of twigs, a flotilla of old gum wrappers and cigarette butts. The surface of the water was rainbowed veined with oil and grease. It eddied and mingled once again with a steady flow from the faucets leading back into the tunnel. The level rose to the markings on the side of the treadle pit. So the tunnel was empty. Marco sighed gracefully. It had all been a nightmare. His fears were groundless. Now all he needed to do was launch the single gondola and go through the tunnel for an inspection of the lights on his exhibits. Yes, all he had to do was sail into the waiting mouth, the hungry mouth, the grinning jaws of death. Marco shrugged, shook his head. No use stalling. He had to go through with it. He turned the lights on. He could use the hand switches en route to stop the tread if he need be. Then he could inspect the cutoff and see if everything was barricaded off. There was nothing to worry about, but he had to be quite sure. He slid the heavy gondola off its truck and into the channel. Holding it with a boat hook, he stooped again and switched on the motor. It chugged. The treadle roamed under the water, and he knew it was moving. The deep, flat-bottomed gondola rested on the moving treadle struts. Marco let the boat hook fill and stepped into the forward seat of the boat. It began to move forward, move towards the red lips, the black mouth. The entrance of the tunnel loomed. Marco leaped from the boat with a spastic, convulsive tremor agitating his limbs. Frantically, he switched off the motor and halted the gondola at the lip of the tunnel. He stood there, all panting in perspiration, for a long moment. Thank God! He thought of it in time. He had almost gone into the tunnel without remembering to turn on the lights. That he could never do. He knew the lights were necessary. How could he have forgotten? Why had he forgotten? Did the tunnel want him to forget? Did it want him to go into the blackness all alone so that it could? Marco shook his head. Such thoughts were childish. Quite deliberately, he walked into the ticket booth and plugged in the cord, controlling the tunnel light circuit. He started the treadle, going, and jumped into the moving boat, barking his left shin. He was still rubbing the sore spot as the boat glided into darkness. Quite suddenly, Marco was in the tunnel, and he wasn't afraid anymore. There was nothing to be afraid of, nothing at all. The boat bumped along slowly, the water gurgled, the treadle groaned. Little blue lights cast a friendly glow at intervals of 40 feet. Little blue lights behind the glass walls of the small papier-mâché exhibits booth set in the tunnel sides. Here was Romeo and Juliet. Here was Antony and Cleopatra. Here was Napoleon and Josephine. Here was the cutout. Marco stopped the boat, halted the treadle, rather, by reaching out and pulling the hand switch set near the water's edge in the left wall of the tunnel. Here was the cutout. Formerly, the tunnel had contained an extra loop, 120 feet more of winding channel, through which boats had doubled back on an auxiliary treadle. Since November, this channel had been cut out, boarded up, sealed up tightly, and cemented at the cracks by Marco's frantic fingers. He had worked until after midnight to do the job, but it was well done. Marco stared at the wall. It had held. Nothing leaked into the cutout. Nothing leaked out of it. The air of the tunnel was fetid, but that was merely a natural musty odor soon to be dispelled, just as Marco's fears were dispelled, now by the sight of the smooth-walled surface. There was nothing to worry about, nothing at all. Marco started the treadle. The boat swept on. Now he could lean back in his double seat and actually enjoy the ride. The tunnel of love would operate again. The Bobby Soxers and the college kids, the sailors and the Hicks would have the romance, their smooching, their dime's worth of darkness. Yes, Marco would sell darkness for a dime. He lived on darkness. He and the Loras would be together, just like Romeo and Juliet, Antony and Cleopatra. Marco and... But that was over. Marco was actually grinning when the boat glided out into the light of day again. The Lars saw the grin and thought it was meant for her. She waved from the side of the channel. "Hello, darling." Marco gaped at the tall blonde in the flowered print dress. She waved at him, and as the boat drew up opposite the disembarking point, she stooped, stopped the motor, and held out her arms to the man in the gondola. His grin disappeared as he rose. "What are you doing here?" "Just thought I'd surprise you. I guess where'd you be going?" Her arms pressed his back. "Oh," he kissed her without giving or receiving any sensation. "You aren't mad, are you, darling? After all, I'm your wife, and I'm going to be working here with you, aren't I? I mean, I'd like to see this old tunnel you've been so mysterious about." Lord, she was a stupid female. Maybe that's why he loved her, because she was stupid and uncalculating and loyal, because she wasn't dark and intense and knowing and hysterical-like. "What on earth were you doing?" she asked. The question threw him off balance. "Why, just going through the tunnel." "All alone?" Dolores giggled. "What's the sense of taking a boat ride through the tunnel of love by yourself? Couldn't you find some girl to keep you company?" "If you only knew," thought Marco. But he didn't say it. He didn't care. "Just inspecting the place," he said. "Seems to be in good shape. Shall we go now?" "Go?" Dolores pouted. "I want to see, too." "There's nothing to see. Come on, darling. Take me through the tunnel just once. After all, I won't be getting a chance after the season opens." "But," she teased his hair with her fingers, "look, I drove all the way down here just to see. What are you acting so mysterious about? You hiding a body in the tunnel or something?" "Good Lord, not that," Marco thought. He couldn't allow her to become suspicious. Not Dolores, of all people. "You really want to go through?" he murmured. He knew she did, and he knew he had to take her now. He had to show her that there was nothing to be afraid of. There was nothing in the tunnel at all. And why couldn't he do that? There was nothing to fear, nothing at all. "So, come along," said Marco. He helped her into the boat, holding the gondola steady in the swirling water as he started the treadle. Then he jumped into the seat beside her and cast off. The boat bumped against the sides of the channel and swayed as he sat down. She gasped. "Be careful or we'll tip," she squealed. "Not a chance. This outfit's safe. Besides, the water's only 3 feet deep at most. You can't get hurt here." "Oh, can't you?" Marco wiped his forehead and grimaced as the gondola edged towards the gulping black hole of the tunnel of love. He buried his face against her cheek and closed his eyes again, the engulfing darkness. "Gee, honey, isn't it romantic?" Dolores whispered. "I bet you used to envy the fellows who took their girls through here, didn't you? Or did you get girls and go through yourself?" Marco wished she'd shut up. This kind of talk he didn't like to hear. "Did you ever take that girl you used to have in the ticket booth in here with you?" Dolores teased. What was her name? Belle?
No, said Marco.
What did you say happened to her at the end of the season, darling?
She ran out on me. Marco kept his head down, his eyes closed. They were in the tunnel now, and he could smell the mustiness of it. It smelled like old perfume, stale, cheap perfume. He knew that smell. He pressed his face against Dolores' cheek. She wore scent, but the other smell still came through.
I never liked her, Dolores was saying. What kind of a girl was she, Marco? I mean, did you ever?
No, no.
Well, don't snap at me like that. I've never seen you act like this before, Marco.
Marco. The name echoed through the tunnel. It bounced off the ceiling, off the walls, off the cutout. It echoed and re-echoed, and then it was taken up from far away in a different voice, a softer voice gurgling through water.
Marco, Marco,
Marco, over and over again until he couldn't stand it.
Shut up, yelled Marco.
Why, not you, Dolores, her.
Her? Are you nuts or something? There's nobody but the two of us here in the dark and...
In the dark.
How could that be?
The lights were on. He left them on.
What was she talking about?
Marco opened his eyes.
They were in the dark.
The lights were out. Perhaps a fuse had blown, perhaps a short circuit. There was no time to think of the possibilities. All Marco knew was the certainty. They were gliding down the dark throat of the tunnel in the dark, nearing the center, nearing the cutout, and the echo. The damned drowned echo whispered Marco. He had to shut it out. He had to talk over it, talk against it, and all at once he was talking fast and shrill.
She did it, Dolores.
I know she did it. Belle. She's here now, in the tunnel. All winter long I felt her, saw her, heard her in my dreams, calling to me to come back. She said I'd never be rid of her. You'd never have me, nobody, and nothing could take me away from her. And I was a fool. I came back. I let you come with me. Now we're here, and she's here. Can't you feel it?
Darling, she clung to him in the dark.
You're not well, are you? Because there's nobody here. You understand that? Don't you? Belle ran away, remember? You told me yourself. She's not here.
Oh, yes, she is, Marco panted. She's here. She's been here all along, ever since last season. She died in this tunnel.
Dolores wasn't clinging to him anymore. She drew away. The boat rocked and bumped the channel sides. He couldn't see anything in the perfume blackness, and he had to get her arms around him again. So he talked faster.
She died here, the night we took a ride together after I closed the concession, the night I told her I was going to marry you, that it was all over between her and me. She jumped out of the boat and tried to take me with her. I guess I fought her.
Belle was hysterical. You must understand that. She kept saying it over and over again, that I couldn't leave her, that she'd never give me up, never. I tried to pull her back into the boat, and she choked me, and then she drowned.
You killed her?
I didn't. It was an accident, suicide, really. I didn't mean to hold her so tight, but she was fighting me. It was just suicide. I knew it looked like murder. I knew what would happen if anyone found out. So I buried her, walled her up behind the cutout. And now she's coming back. She won't let me go.
What shall I do, Dolores?
What can I do?
You...
Dolores screamed. Marco tried to put his arms around her. She moved away, shrieking. The echo shattered the darkness. He lunged at her. The boat rocked and tipped. There was a splash.
Come back, you fool! Marco stood up, groping in darkness.
Somewhere Dolores was wailing and gurgling. The gondola was empty now. The blackness was spinning round and round, sucking Marco down into it. He felt a bump. Knew the boat had stopped. He jumped out into the water. The treadles were slippery with slime. Cold waves slapped about his waist. He tried to find Dolores in the darkness in the water. No wailing now. No gurgles.
Dolores!
No answer. No sound at all. The bumping and the lapping ceased.
Dolores!
She hadn't run away. There was nowhere to run to. And he would have heard the splashing. Then she was... His hands found flesh. Wet flesh. Floating flesh. She had fallen against the side of the boat. Bumped her head. But only a few seconds had passed. Nobody drowns in a few seconds. She had passed out, poor kid. He dragged her into the boat.
Nan moved away, moved through the darkness as he propped her on the seat beside him, and put his arms around the clammy, soggy wetness of her dress. Her head rolled on his shoulder as he chafed her wrist. "There now, it's all right. Don't you see, darling, it's all right now. I'm not afraid any more. Belle isn't here. There's nothing to worry about. Everything will be all right." The more he said it, the more he knew it was true. What had he done, frightening the girl half to death? Marco cursed the slowness of the treadles as the boat bumped its way out of the tunnel. The mechanism wasn't working properly, but there was no time to bother about that. He had to bring Dolores around. He kissed her hair. He kissed her ear, but she was still cold. "Come on, honey," he whispered. "Brace up. This is a tunnel of love, remember?" The boat bumped out into the daylight. Marco stared ahead. They were safe now, safe from the tunnel, safe from Belle. He and Dolores. Dolores? Marco peered at the prow of the bumping gondola as it creaked over the treadles. He peered at the obstruction floating in its path, floating face upward in the water, as if tied to the boat, with a red string running from its gashed forehead. Dolores! She had fallen in the water when she jumped out of the gondola, fallen and struck her head the way Belle had struck her head. It was Dolores' body that bumped against the front of the boat and retarded its progress. She was dead. But if that was Dolores out there in the water, then what? Marco turned his head ever so slowly. For the first time, he glanced down at the seat beside him, at what lay cradled in his arms. For the first time, Marco saw what he had been kissing. The boat glided back into the tunnel of love.